Welcome to the Young China Watchers podcast. We're a global network of young professionals interested in China. My name is Sam Colomby. On May 25th, our London chapter is kicking off their annual climate series with a webinar on the geopolitics of climate change. They've invited Isabel Hilton of China Dialogue to share her insight. For this month's podcast, we decided to have Caroline Kan over to talk about recent developments in climate negotiations and China's environmental policy. Caroline is a longtime climate and environment journalist, as well as the author of Under Red Skies, a memoir on life in China through the eyes of her family.
Hi, Caroline.
Caroline was the 2019 winner of our Young China Watcher of the Year award, so it's a pleasure to welcome her on the show.
I'm very glad that you're able to take this call. So, my first question is, I want to look at the Leaders Summit on Climate, right? And I want to hear from you, what were you most surprised about at the summit? And sort of what is the key takeaway for you?
Yeah, I think the summit itself, what has a big significance in terms of, you know, it successfully get 40 leaders from the world to actually attend the same meeting the same day, and to, no matter announcing new climate goals or not, but the fact that people get together to just to discuss this issue, I think it has itself has the big significance. And of course, like during the meeting, many leaders actually raise up their climate ambitions. So that is also very important, including like Canada, the US, and South Korea, like announcing to stop financing overseas coal projects. So those are very important just before this United Nations Climate Conference scheduled this year in the UK. Also to get people's attention on climate change again during Trump's administration, that the US left the Paris Agreement. So for many years, so climate change kind of like get out of people's attention. So the fact that you know, the United States president calling all the leaders to attend, I think is very important.
Yeah, so it had a great, I guess, symbolic meaning, right? The fact that the US, I think they even literally said, we're back, right? We're back on the stage. How was that received in China? The fact that the US had a sort of four-year hiatus, and obviously Xi Jinping made good use of that. How has this, the return of the US been received in China?
So in the past few years, that Chinese President Xi Jinping has been kind of like promoting climate and the environment. And in the past few years, I think China has been like kind of like enjoying this space of being the promoter and also on the international stage of gaining all the attention, especially last September when President Xi Jinping announced that China is going to peak carbon and reach carbon neutrality, while the carbon peaking in 2030 and the carbon neutrality in 2060. So that gap helped China to get a lot of the praise. And when China and the West right now is just cannot agree on many, many issues, but the fact that climate change has been one of the rare channels for China to talk with the West and to kind of lead in this international stage. And domestically, although there have been, it's always the case that there are the industries, especially power industries, been lobbying for more space to develop, to use more coal. So it's always the case that domestically there are different voices. But since she announces a big climate goal, it's kind of like a political correctness in China now to talk about carbon neutral. So that is that totally changed the narrative of talking about climate change in China.
You say that with the return of the US, there's this new opportunity for cooperation. There's been a lot of optimism since Biden came into power, and especially since he appointed Kerry as a key figure in that. But then I think the day after the summit, we heard from Foreign Minister Wang Yi, and he said, paraphrasing, he said the cooperation will depend on the US stance on other issues. So China's, as he calls it, the internal affairs. Was he trying to sort of narrow that gap again, ask for some concessions on other fields? Or how do you see that evolving?
I have been seeing experts saying that climate might be the seems like the only thing that China and the US can sit down and talk about and try to achieve some progress. And despite all the disputes on other issues like human rights and on trade war, but at the same time, I think maybe in the shorter term, yes, sure, the leaders of two countries can sit down and talk. But I do think that in the longer term, at least the countries should have some basic level of trust. You cannot expect two countries that will hate each other, even in a Cold War atmosphere, to cooperate on a long term on such a big issue. So at least there should be a certain level of trust and the willingness to cooperate exist. Well, think about this, like, okay, so climate change is not only an issue about science research, it's also about manufacturing or a technology breakthrough. And to make it to develop into a level that both countries and also other countries can benefit from this cooperation, the cooperation is the first thing, right? You cannot say, well, the two countries, they having a quite hostile attitude to each other to really share their research, their data, their development. So I do think, like, in longer term, it's still important for the two countries to actually achieve a certain kind of understanding.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that maybe in the short term we can treat this in isolation, but in the long term it needs to be a holistic approach on all fields to build that trust.
Because, like, to cooperate, it's not about you and I just say we are going to cooperate. It's about you do have the channel to talk, to trust, to understand, to collaborate on something. It's not about, okay, the two countries today sit together, say, we release a joint statement, then that is cooperation, right? You do need, you know, in practice, you do things rather than to talk.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we've seen a lot of mixed messaging, right? So I'm thinking of, for instance, the Alaska talks, where in the moment it looked like they were like just at each other's throats, and then afterwards we hear from I think it was Yang Jiechi who said it went great. We made so much progress, and then now at the climate talk we have a lot of coming together on these issues, but then afterwards we hear from Wang Yi, hold on, it's not going as great as you think. We need to also solve these other issues. So overall, do you think there is a trend towards more cooperation?
I think it's still early to say, because the world is still expecting China to say something more. The climate community was kind of disappointed at the fact that China didn't really bring new pledges to the summit. So I think people are still not totally give up faith that China might give more before the COP26. But just after the summit, Xie Zhenhua said during a presser in Beijing that China and the US have several things they can work together. So they named the few things, including work on reducing the methane emission and also the hydrogen development. So yeah, I think it's an interesting time for us to see in the coming few months that how China and the US is going to carry out this cooperation plan.
Yeah. So then I want to raise a point. So in a recent article in The Wire, we had several observers comment on the fact that, okay, cooperation is one thing, but a more effective strategy may be to compete, but compete in a sort of in a coordinated approach. So under the WTO, so to set out the framework and then just let the companies do what they want in terms of decarbonization. What are your thoughts on that?
I think overall, it's just my own opinion that if China and the US or China and the EU get an atmosphere of like competing, overall, I don't think it's a bad thing. You know, it's not like in other issues. I think in climate change, why not? If all countries come on the stage, become like ready to compete to see who contribute the most, or who gives the most ambitious plan, I think it's a good thing for the world for us to reach this rising degree limit. by the end of this century. So I think it's a good thing.
Moving away from US-China cooperation a bit and just look at China's recent efforts, because there's been a lot of developments this year. And let's start with the 14th five-year plan. Again, I'm going to ask you, what was the most surprising for you? What was the most disappointing element for you? And sort of what is your general evaluation of the plan for the next 5 years?
I don't think there was anything that like super surprising in terms of like emission and energy and climate change. But I think it's China's style that it kind of like wants to do more than it promised. So in the 14th five-year plan, it's kind of like every target was expected. But of course, like people who have been watching closely at climate change always want China to promise more. Like people want China to have a bigger carbon reduction goal, want China to have a carbon cap, but China didn't. But I think there are some good signs in the five-year plan. One is China says it's going to make a climate constructing law. It doesn't call it like climate change law, but it's more like that. And also to because after the five-year plan, for the like national five-year plans, and all the provinces and industries are going to make their own five-year plan to reach the goals. And also for the first time, China said it's going to also care about the non-carbon greenhouse gas emission. So for the first time, China mentioned the methane reduction, how to control that. So yeah, there are some good things in it. And personally, I think normally in the former pattern is that China always achieve the goals before the deadline come. So maybe there are something surprising, positively surprising, before the deadline of the 14th five-year plan, that is 2025.
Under-promise, over-perform.
Yeah.
Right? It's what they're saying about Biden as well.
Yeah, and also I think it's really important and interesting to see how the provincial level government are going to make their roadmaps to reach carbon peaking. So that is important because it's easy like for outsiders to say, well, you can stop using coal. Everyone knows coal is polluting, but it's interesting to see how the provinces, which are so largely depending on coal, how are they going to actually transit with maintaining social stability, with providing enough jobs. I'm excited to see, and I'm looking forward to see.
You mentioned earlier as well that in this 5-year plan that there would be an extra focus on the other emissions apart from carbon. But then we have the carbon market that's launching now. And some critics are saying that some of the promises that have been made by the 2,000 or so companies that are targeted by the carbon market in the initial stage, that a lot of the promises they are making may actually have an adverse effect on other emissions. So, for instance, moving to gas may have effects on methane release. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see that play out?
I'm not so sure about that, but that sounds very interesting. But I think the core discussion on carbon market is how useful, what kind of role it can play in reducing carbon emission in the short term. You know, the carbon market is basically like, okay, all the participate in it, given a certain quota to emit. But if you are efficient enough, if you are doing enough, then you can sell your actual points or something. But right now, the allowance is too much and the price might be too low to make it really function. But I think it's hard to avoid, like in the European like carbon market, I think there was also a period of time when it wasn't really function well. So people are very excited for the launch of it, but we have to give it enough time, space to develop and to make it better. But at the same time, I think the fact that the national carbon market is launched this year is a big achievement. Like I talked to some, I wrote an article about a guy who'd been waiting for this carbon market for 10 years. So to him, like, he said, you have no idea how complicated it is, like all the difficulties in this. It's like if you go to a small province, small city, and talk to the local official, even the environmental like bureau chief or something, they have no idea what is climate change and what is carbon emission, why it is important. So they said, like, each time we go to this a small city, we have to start from the beginning of how a polar bear is suffering like from the climate change, on what, how sad the story is and why it is important to everyone. So you have to consider, think from this perspective, like maybe 5 years ago, very few people really cared and worked on climate change. And to from there, it's a big gap to fill. And now, okay, you trying to get 2,000 enterprises to join the carbon market. To me, it's like a huge challenge. And to that guy I was just talking about, to him, like, it's like, oh, 10 years waiting.
Right. So then finally, I have one more question, and then we'll move on to recommendations. I want to hear from you what you would recommend people to read. But first, let's talk about COP26. You already said that you're hoping that there will be more developments on both the US and China side leading up to COP26. Now, Xi Jinping in September last year, like you said, made a huge announcement. I mean, the 2060 carbon neutrality goal is huge. What other areas do you think might be addressed by COP26? What other commitments might be made aside from that?
One main thing, people, no matter journalists or climate NGOs, are looking forward China to do is to announce something, still announce something about coal use, especially like on BRI projects. China is, I'm not sure if it's the only, but at least one of the few countries still supporting, financially supporting overseas coal projects. So that is a major thing that climate community is looking forward to hear from China. And also domestic coal use. But of course, it's understandable that you have to balance the jobs, the social aspects, and also the environment. But I do hope that there will be more ambitious plan on coal.
Mm. Yeah, me too. so then finally, I just, what I would like to hear, and we ask this to all our guests, is what do you read to stay on top of this news? So what newsletters do you subscribe to sort of stay on top of your beat?
Well, at first I recommend to follow Bloomberg Green, the platform launched January 2020. You will find fresh reportings from all over the world every day. And well, China Dialogue focus on China and the environment, and they do long in-depth reporting. And there's a book about Himalaya and Tibet. It's a book called Meltdown in Tibet.
Meltdown in Tibet.
Yeah. So it is about like China's construction of dams in the Tibetan era. This kind of construction will have a very damaging effect on the ecosystem. And this Himalaya area is ecologically very fragile. But right now, China and India are planning to build a lot of hydropower projects there.
Right. Meltdown in Tibet by Michael Buckley, I'm seeing. Great. Thank you, Caroline. It's been really great to talk to you. It's very, very interesting to hear from somebody who's so embedded in China climate change reporting.
Thank you.
That was Caroline Kan, author and climate journalist. Thank you to Caroline for joining us, and thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about our organization, go to youngchinawatches.com to find out about upcoming events, read interviews with China experts, or replay one of our webinars. My name is Sam Colomby. The music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions.